So my name is Hannah Schmiedel. I am here at Princeton Public Library on February 27th, 2020, as part of the Voices of Princeton project. I'm here today with Matthew and Janelle Wilkinson.
I'm Janelle Wilkinson. I am the interviewer.
And I am Matthew Wilkinson, the interviewee.
So I thought, Matthew, that it would be interesting for people to hear your story since you were born, raised, educated in Princeton, left for university, and then came back as a teacher in the district. So would you like to start out with you as a young child?
I would, but I'm going to respectfully ask that you call me Matt, because I only get Matthew when I'm in trouble. And hopefully I'm not going to be in trouble on this one. All right, so what would you like me to start with?
Start out with born and raised in Princeton, and then your education as in the elementary, middle school, and high school.
All right. It was June 21st, 1960. I was born in Princeton Hospital, which no longer is in the location that it was. It was off of Witherspoon Street. And I had the good fortune of growing up on Littlebrook Road, which is off of Snowden, down by Lake Carnegie, and right behind my house, backed up to my house, was Littlebrook Elementary School. So I got to literally run through my backyard to my elementary school, which was a fabulous school with the Ravioli the giraffe is our mascot, still is the mascot. And I spent all the way through fifth grade there. And I got 1 year in middle school at the Valley Road School. And then after that, they had finished construction on John Witherspoon Middle School, so we went over to John Witherspoon Middle School. And I spent 2 years there, which were your typical traumatic middle school years. And I went to the big time over to the Little Tigers of Princeton High School across the road, and I finished up my 4 years as a Little Tiger.
Can you tell some stories of your elementary school years?
My grandfather, on my mom's side, had a small farm over in West Windsor by the train station. And because of that, I was, and I guess so was my mother, deeply connected to the farm experience. So we as children wanted what my grandfather had. My mother, I'm sure, was reluctant, but she allowed us to get certain things. And one of them was a goose who was named Lunar Orbiter, because my father worked at the RCA laboratories out on Route 1, and he designed antennas for space shuttles, which my middle name, which we didn't go through, but I'll bring it out there, is Matthew Astro Wilkinson, because when I was born in 1960, my father was working on an antenna that was called the Astro Project. So I got the middle name Astro. So anyway, the goose was named Lunar Orbiter, and we got him as a gosling. It's a fancy word for a little goose. And he did what all little geese do. He grew up. And when he grew up, he decided he wanted to fly. So you'll recall I told you I lived right next to Littlebrook Elementary School. Well, the goose flew over the tree line. And to the joy of the goose and to the horror of, sure, the elementary school kindergarten teachers, he dive-bombed the children and sent them scurrying inside. And soon after that, The principal contacted my parents, and we didn't understand what had gone on other than Lunar Orbiter had taken flight, but the goose left the day after, and all we know is he went to West Windsor, and we were told he had a happy life, which I doubt, but anyway. So that was one story. Another one that is just so fond for me is the current principal over at Johnson Park, Dr. Ginsburg. He was the elementary school teacher or principal at Littlebrook. And
when you were there?
No, this was afterwards, but it was such a great... It captures the flavor of Littlebrook, and I'm sure a lot of the other elementaries, but it captures the flavor of community. So when there was spring and summer and in the fall, it was fine because my father couldn't see the elementary school. But when winter came, it was in plain sight because all the shrubbery and trees lost their leaves. So for some unknown reason, and I'm sure it wasn't Dr. Ginsburg's doing, but the grounds crew decided to paint the sandbox that was probably 10 feet from the property line, Big Bird yellow. And it was such an eyesore. And it made my father furious. So he called up Dr. Ginsburg and conveyed how annoyed he was at the Big Bird sandbox. And the next day, there was the grounds crew with a single bucket of green paint. And they painted the side that only my father could see green. Excuse me. And my father was so thrilled by that solution that to his dying day, Dr. Ginsburg was his hero. I guess that's why Dr. Ginsburg is still in education, because he's a problem solver. But that's another great Littlebrook story.
Any other Littlebrook stories that you can think of?
Yeah, this one I'm not so proud of. It'll definitely convey how times have changed. I was very small, and still am, 5 foot tall. And in my elementary school years, it was a show of strength to get in a particular part of the schoolyard and throw rocks on top of the school. And I'm sure with all my might I tried, but the rock fell short and smashed the art room window. And we scurried like little mice away from there, and I never told my father. But somehow he found out. So that was on a weekend. So the following Monday, I was marched into the principal's office, who at that time wasn't Dr. Ginsburg. If it was, he would have found a different solution. But my punishment was I went down with the custodian during art class with a tape measure, though I didn't even know how to use a tape measure, but I was made to act like I knew how to use a tape measure. And myself and the custodian measured out the new window panes. And I was horrified, embarrassed, but I can tell you I never threw another rock in my life. So back then that was a form of behavioral modification.
What do you think, and we'll jump to this in a little bit, but what do you think you said that maybe Dr. Ginsburg would have found a different punishment? How do you feel about student responsibility today, being a high school teacher and, quote, punishments that fit the crime? How do you, unquote, how do you foresee, or how would you see a punishment today that would be different based on a student who did something like that, throw a rock at a window and crack the window, break the window?
How would that student be handled today?
Yeah, how do you think that student would be handled today?
I would imagine that the student would be asked, how do you think the students felt coming into their school and their window was broken and the sense of community damage and what could they do in the future to prevent things like that happening, and maybe some activities to generate awareness on correct behaviors and doing the right thing. I think that's probably what would happen nowadays.
Do you see that there are advantages or disadvantages in either one? And I'm specifically thinking of your comment about how embarrassed you were. Do you think that embarrassment is something today that students...
I believe that there's some value in taking ownership of one's behaviors. But therein, again, what form of ownership do we feel is appropriate? Back then, in 1967, that was a acceptable form of communication. I'm not going to say in 2020 that's acceptable anymore. So I think, as both you and I, my wife and I are both teachers at Princeton High School, both the students have evolved and teaching has evolved. So I think we have to roll with the times.
Moving on, do you have any stories, thoughts, middle school, Valley Road School? Valley Road School is no longer a school. It is now the administrative offices. Do you have any memories of that? Or of middle school, of John Witherspoon, before we move on to the high school?
I had the privilege of going through all the Princeton school systems when it was commonplace for the teachers, a lot of the teachers, to have gone through the schools themselves, such as, you know, like I'm more of an oddity now, but there it was more common. And also, they lived in the community.
Mm.
They lived around the schools. You'd see them walking to their houses. You'd see them in the grocery stores. You'd see them everywhere. So there was a very strong sense of identity and community and awareness of that. That's not the case anymore.
Why aren't teachers living in the community anymore?
I don't know. You'd have to ask them. But
why are we not living?
We're not living in the community anymore because we couldn't afford to live in the community anymore.
On a teacher's salary.
Yeah, that's part of it. And also we aspired to do some other things that Princeton couldn't give us. But anyway, there's strong history in Princeton Regional Schools. My mother went to Princeton Regional, went to Princeton High School, 1920-something. Maybe it was the early 30s, but in that period, time period. All my siblings went there. My daughter's going to graduate this year, our daughter. So there's deep, deep, deep history in that school. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed knowing that history and being a part of that history and seeing and hearing teachers talk to me that had gone through what I was going through as a student. So that was very meaningful. There was a strong connection.
So can we move on to the high school?
Sure.
Your time in the high school. There's a specific story you tell that I find very interesting that I'd like you to tell, that you had a conversation with your guidance counselor one time, and your guidance counselor gave you advice which you didn't follow.
Ms. Thompson. Ms. Thompson was... she was old school. She spoke the truth as she saw it. I don't fault her for that. but she made a she made a calculated error because I don't think she realized her audience, and she was talking to a parent that had gone through the Great Depression. My father and
and your mother
and
too.
My mother and had they had both overcome
adversity,
whatever was in front of them, and they knew what. They knew what it was to roll up one's sleeve and get after something, no matter how hard it was. So anyway, Ms. Thompson advised my father that I should just put my sights towards the trades, that I wasn't college material. And I remember coming out of that guidance meeting, and I knew right from the get-go that my father wasn't buying what she was selling. And we never looked back. So, it was, you know, it was achieve. Do your best, and your best will be good enough to get what you want. So, I don't know, you know, how people feel about this, but if they believe that people can tell what's happening from thereafter, Ms. Thompson's probably smiling that because she wanted only the best for people, but she's probably smiling about how wrong she was.
Right. She told you to don't bother with college.
Yeah, now
you
I have a master's plus 30. So.
Yeah, you're on your way to a doctorate.
Right. But anyway, she meant well.
So we know now as teachers, both of us, that all students can achieve. If they want. And it's not up to us to make that decision for them.
No, we are there to facilitate the path that they choose to go on and try and encourage them to go on the path that both inspire them and they're capable of. But it's definitely... A joint effort, you know, both educators and students and the administration coming together to help these young people, such as myself back then, reach their highest potential. So I'm, in all due respect to Ms. Thompson, she should have really found out what I was aspiring towards rather than telling me. But anyway, she made a mistake.
So now you've been teaching at Princeton High School since the early 1990s. How do you see the students are different now?
1986, actually, I went in there.
Mid-80s. How do you feel the students are different now in 2020? With 2020 hindsight, perhaps, than they were in when you started. How do you see, what are the differences, whether it's demographically or culturally or emotionally? How have students evolved in the last years?
Again, we can go back to my comment about the teachers living in the community. So did the shop owners. You knew where the shop owners lived, Harry's Luncheonette and Erkin's Hardware Store and the bowling alley. And I can go on and on and on and on and list all the stores that were owned and operated by community members. Well, you'd be hard-pressed, I think, to find few that people live in town anymore. They're names that are found around the country and corporations. People are, to a degree, transient through Princeton now. They come in because it's a phenomenal educational district, and they buy a house, and they live in the house as long as their children are enrolled in the public schools, and then they flip the house and they're gone. So I realized this poignantly, I went to my high school reunion this November, and I'm looking at my fellow 1979 alumni group, and I'm wondering how many will come back for my daughter's reunion at the same year.
How many of your daughter's classmates will
come back? Because they're coming back to a place that was only their home for maybe a couple of years. And if that, it's a global high school now. It's a global school district. And it wasn't that. It was, we thought back in the 70s that West Windsor was like, I don't know, Mongolia. I mean, it was so far away. But that's who came to our high school, West Windsor. They didn't have their own high school at that point. And now you have the Cranberry students that, you know, they get teased about being farmers and things like that. But so Princeton's always been the home to other communities near us because of its strong educational roots. But now we're, the world is coming to Princeton High School to get educated. So when you walk through the halls of Princeton High School, I'm sure John Witherspoon in the elementary schools, it's so diverse, which is wonderful, but it's different.
It's just different.
It's different, and it has its own plethora of positives, but it has some drawbacks to it. Which, I mean, I don't know if it's appropriate for this interview, but, you know, that could be something that's discussed some other time. But, you know, there's always positives and things, challenges when you get changes that are so dramatic, which it is dramatic compared to what it was for me.
How do you see yourself? What advantages do you have as a former student of Princeton High School who is now teaching at Princeton High School?
Well, and this is probably for anyone that listens to this within the administration of Princeton Regional Schools, they're going to want to find a giant rock to hide under. But the other day, my daughter poignantly said, I wish I'd never gone to Princeton High School. And this is a young woman who, by any measurement, has flourished at Princeton High School. Blossomed, exploded with accolades. And the reason she said that is Princeton High School is a pressure cooker for stress. It might as well be a petri dish for breeding stress. It is so competitive. It is so expected. Certain things are just expected. You are expected to go to college. You are expected to go to these colleges. You are expected to get these SAT scores. You are expected to get this many, take this many APs. And, you know, when these kids go through that, it's a wonder that they are as healthy as they are. So, I have an advantage because I know what it's like to struggle at Princeton High School. I know what it's like to feel minimalized. I know what it's like to be told you're not going to achieve. So, I'm a voice. I'm the eyes for those kind of kids. And there are lots of them in that school district, that maybe aren't feeling that they can achieve, especially with that amount of expectations on them. So that's kind of the banner I've flown. That's kind of the sword that I've wielded to try and help that part of the population. And even the ones that achieve, like our daughter, still walk out of the school to a degree beaten up. Do I think that's going to change at Princeton? No. I think that's the new normal at Princeton, unfortunately.
Can you talk about the different types of populations at Princeton High School? Because not all kids take 4 or 5 AP classes in a year, 6 or 7 or 8 by the end of their high school career. There are different types of students. Can you talk about how the school and the district in general helps all kinds of students and where you think they may fall short?
I actually am quite impressed by the sincere interest that school district has in trying to accommodate and reach every kid, every student. If you want to succeed, you can in that school district. The problem is, what does succeed mean? And for some kids, success is learning a trade. And when I went to Princeton High School, there was trades taught within the school. Now we bust the kids out to Mercer County.
But most kids don't even get that ability to have those trades.
No, a lot don't even realize or get within that. But the school district is really, I use the word sincerely, trying to provide for all. But if you look at it like a pie, like an apple pie, and you're going to decide how to slice up that pie, there is going to be a very, very, very large portion of that pie dedicated to the college-driven, inspired kids. So a lot of the resources go towards that high percent of the population. And there are programs for the other percents of that pie, if you will, in that descriptive. And as important as Princeton tries to have that be valued, it goes without saying that it's hard to feel valued for those kids when they don't see what they're ceiling or what they're reaching for is that prominent within the school. So it's easy for that kind of population, that part of the population, to feel minimalized, which is really unfortunate. But it's the current state of affairs.
Do you feel that that population is minimalized because the majority of the population is academic?
Yes, without a doubt.
The vast majority of students are highly academically motivated. Would you agree?
Yes, and that's back to that stress pressure cooker.
Correct.
That we talked about.
Correct.
Yep.
And how do you think that those students who are not academically motivated, How are they succeeding?
Well, they better hope they had a father and mother like I did.
Hmm.
But it's got to be, I mean, the first line of support, I would hope, would come from the family. But if you have two mothers, or two, could be two mothers, but if you have two parental pair that are both working, or you just have one single parent that's working, I mean, we all have heard what that's like. So they might not have the resources nor the even the energy to devote to inspiring their child as much as they want to. So then it becomes the school's lost a partner because the parent can't, for whatever reason, step up within that partnership. And it's unfair to expect educators and administrators to be able to lose a partner and still achieve the same. So sometimes the student gets inspired and they reach their potential, and lots of other times they don't. So, I mean, that's not going to change. We were always going to have those kind of unfortunate scenarios. But, again, I think the school does its darndest to try and minimize it.
I concur. So, moving towards the end of the interview, are there any thoughts or stories or ideas that you would like to share about being educated in Princeton and now being an educator in Princeton Public Schools?
Any student that has the good fortune of being enrolled in a Princeton public school, I truly hope that they realize and maximize what that school district does. And if they do, they're going to reap the benefits for the rest of their lives.
So, moving back to your elementary school years, can you talk to us about what your neighborhood was like on Little Brook Road North and some of the bylaws or neighbors or...
All right. Well, this will definitely get the pot simmering or boiling. And I imagine there's not a lot of people in Princeton that even know about this. So whoever listens to this, you can fact check me and you'll find out I'm correct. But Little Brook Elementary School area was, and part of it, the neighborhood, was purchased by two engineers from RCA. That's how my dad purchased the property on Little Brook Road. And these engineers bought this open land, which, by the way, Little Brook School was where the municipal sewage yard was, which a lot of people don't know. But anyway, they purchased all these acre lots, and they sold them to the engineers, or the at least the employees of RCA. So you had this whole development, giant development. It's not even, it wasn't a development, streets that were owned by RCA employees. And then I think they probably sold outside of RCA. But anyway, that particular group formed a corporation called Carnassa Park. And I'm sure some enthusiastic researcher could dig up the bylaws for Karnassa Park, but I'll give you a little bit of it. It was very specific, and Karnassa Park bylaws stood were followed for, oh gosh, over 40 years maybe?
Can you give the date approximately, well, the date that your parents bought there?
They bought the property in 1955. So probably in the early 50s that was purchased. And then I don't know when they constructed Karnassa Park, the bylaws, but soon after that. And they, you know, it's like any kind of developmental bylaws. You know, things like, not that this was in theirs, but, you know, you can't have picket fences, you can't hang laundry out. You know, association bylaws have lots of rules. And this particular bylaw that really caught my attention was who within Karnassa Park could purchase homes. And I'll leave it to this point. There were many, well, there was certainly groups of people, racial and ethnicity, that were not allowed to buy within Karnassa Park. And that stood for years.
Who was allowed to buy?
Well, we know RCA employees were allowed to buy. White Caucasians were allowed to buy.
Who was not allowed to buy? Do you know?
Specifically, African Americans were not allowed to buy.
Do you know if any other?
I don't know if they. I don't know if they ever stated that. And my father was horrified by that. But it stood in the bylaws for years. And to this day, I don't know how many African Americans live over there. I don't think because of Karnassa Park, but historically, they weren't welcomed, which is a real embarrassment for a community such as Princeton. So that's one of those little those stories that are often not told. But my father was a genealogist besides being a electrical engineer, and truth usurped all.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.